connection is some combination of spark, attraction, and intimacy.
Which is
an oasis.
So
Micah hates it.
Try
it's into me see.
Oh my god, it's so like dad joke.
I love dad jokes.
The attraction is out of my control, but the intimacy is absolutely in my control. This idea that we have free will is something I'm constantly interrogating on my own. And I don't think we have free will until you learn that kind of metacognition. Because for most people, they're just running patterns. Turns out we're all just little kids with arrested development.
These sort of moments of really intense hardship in relationships can be portals to something that is vastly better that, you know, no one can even conceive of in the moment.
Well said.
Thanks, my love.
Today on Modern Relationships, I'm sitting with Aika Ho and Camilla Herman, a couple who's been together for over a decade and, in their own words, are on their second marriage. Aika is a partner at Acme Capital, and Camilla is an entrepreneur. Up ahead, you'll hear them go deep on relationship yoga, their framework for using intimate relationships as a path to growth and liberation.
All right, Camilla, Aika, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Eric.
So about a month ago, you introduced me to a new concept that I want you guys to unpack because I thought it was a really interesting one. What is relationship yoga?
So relationship yoga, as we experience it, is this idea that the path to full liberation, full experience of aliveness, full enlightenment, if you will, can be through your most intimate relationships. And this is not a path for the faint of heart. First of all, there are endless paths to full aliveness. This is just one of them. But it is particularly challenging because it requires you to really let go of this idea that there is an external safe space and source all of your security, control, and approval from within, which is challenging.
Yeah. So I think the way we've thought about relationship yoga, and it really is a core principle within our relationship, is this idea that the whole point of life is trying to be whole, right? Like all of the religious teachings in the world, spiritual teachings in the world, at the core of it, the essence really is around coming back to wholeness. And our relationship we view as one of the main canvas, main channels for us to be able to do that, in that we're gonna get triggered by things that the other person does, right? Like we may get annoyed. And the idea is whatever it is that bothers us about the other person is a reflection of what is not yet integrated within me. So if I'm annoyed with Camilla about something, or, you know, there's a trait that I get huffy about once in a while, whatever that trigger is a mirror for me to see what is not yet owned in me or what is still separated. So relationship yoga then becomes this really beautiful way of practicing in a day-to-day, moment-to-moment level of just really seeing what is unowned in you. And it doesn't necessarily have to be just in a romantic context, but I think in a romantic context, it's really powerful. There's so much vulnerability to it, right? You're really opening up. I really open myself up to Camilla and vice versa. But certainly you could practice relationship yoga with your friends, with your parents. Oh, that's a really big one. With your colleagues, and just seeing every trigger as an opportunity to learn what is not yet healed.
I heard this quote the other day. We find ourselves attracted to certain people because we have an instinctual way of finding the person who can trigger us the best. And on the other hand, also gives us the opportunity for mutual healing.
Spot on.
There's a quote that I love from Byron Katie, which is that there is nothing and no one in life that is not a teacher. And so from that perspective, of course, the people that we bump up against are the ones who are just reflecting back to us what is unowned and unloved in ourselves.
Yeah. Or in another way, Dana Chapman, who is part of Conscious Leadership and has been a really big part of our lives, She likes to say, you spot it, you got it.
So say more about what this means concretely. Like if I'm, what are things that, you know, might trigger us? I get mad that, you know, someone's late to stuff.
What a great example, Eric. Aika, do you want to take that one?
Yeah. Being late definitely is a trigger for me. And
I am the one who is late.
Yes.
Same.
And Eika is the one who is triggered.
Correct. And you know, this is a small kind of mundane example, but if I peel into it, right? Okay, Camilla pisses me off. I get huffy. We're late to something because she took her time getting ready, et cetera. It's not about her. If I go deeper, it's like, okay, why am I angry, sad, upset, et cetera, that we're late? It's because it's either a threat to security control and or approval, or all three, right? This is the mind's way of catastrophizing things. We're late to a dinner that friends are hosting. And in my mind, it's like, oh my God, if we're late, then they're going to think poorly of us. They're not going to want to be friends with us. We're no longer going to have any friends in life. We're going to be forever alone. And if there's a apocalypse, we're going to have to fend for ourselves. You know, it's just this funny thing that happens with our minds when there's a fear. And so when that happens, it's like, okay, what Camilla did in being late is a mirror for me, for my own work of, wow, there's some fear there around not having friends, being alone, apocalypse, etc. And rather than focusing on what triggered it, it's, can I sit with myself and just, okay, there's a little one who's scared. Okay, let's be with that fear. No, scientifically, no emotion, which is just a configuration of biochemical processes, naturally stay within your system beyond 2 minutes, right? So if there's any mood or there's any feeling that stays beyond 2 minutes, it's because psychosomatically I'm using stories in my head to re-trigger those biochemical processes to feel those sensations in my body. And so if I could just sit with that fear, let it pass, and it's like, okay, I'm okay. Woman sitting on chair, you know, woman is next to friends. Just come back to the reality of the moment. So that's like a good example of something really mundane that I think reflects a lot of the work that we do together individually and collectively as a couple.
Yeah. And I think all of the small things are also all of the big things. Right. So being late seems so insignificant, but the reason that it triggers Eika is because it connects to really deep patterns that got laid down in her neurological wiring as a kid, you know? And so that's why when, you know, something small like being late sets us off, it's not because it's about that present moment. It's because it's about that existential fear that comes up from that, you know, really primal wiring. And so all of these different tools that we have to literally rewire the brain so that instead of, you know, a super highway firing every single time, you have all of these little branching roads and you can start to take different routes to the same destination, which is getting to the dinner. That's really, really powerful. Do you have something you want to contribute?
I was just listening. The dog is actively involved in the conversation. Okay, so this is really interesting. So basically what you're saying is, hey, when you get triggered about something, observe the types of things that you tend to get triggered about, recognize that those things, especially if the trigger is kind of disproportionate to the offense, so to speak, you know, have more to do with you than the actual act itself, or more to do with something in your past. And if you can accept that, then you can sort of work on rewiring that trigger, or sort of dulling or lessening that trigger. And you can do that by sort of sitting with it, or one method to do is sort of sitting with it, letting it process, letting it sort of move through the body. Is that a, how'd you edit that characterization, or what would you add to it in terms of, I mean, if we could not get triggered, that would change our lives drastically, right? So, or trigger even significantly less, or handle that trigger in a more productive way. So what else would you say on this topic? Because a lot of people are interested in like communication tactics and or things like nonviolent communication or other things, but it's actually hard to apply it when they need it the most because they're too triggered to, you know, make sense of it.
My favorite saying from Hoffman is, if it's hysterical, it's historical. And that's just been pretty etched in my brain, and we say it to each other all the time. If the response is disproportionate, you're probably triggered, your little one is triggered, something in the past is now in the present, and you're not really seeing the moment as is. There's tons of projections going on. This is, I mean, we've been together now for 10 going on 11 years.
Yeah.
And we were babies when we got together. We were in our early to mid 20s and we had zero tools, you know? So it's like when we triggered each other, it would just be like really messy humans being upset at each other. And the triggers flowed. And then over time, as we picked up more and more tools and learned how to do stuff individually and collectively, I feel like now we're much better and pros at handling what happens when we're triggered. Camilla was just talking about this the other day with another friend. It's much harder to pull yourselves out of being triggered when the other person is also triggered. It's like double trigger. And I think relationships, we have a knack of finding people where we have interlocking patterns that, you know, when one person gets triggered, it triggers the other thing and the core wounding of the other person, right? So as we both have done our own inner work, our capacity to hold space when the other person is triggered has also increased. So like if I'm triggered and Camilla's not triggered, she then is an amazing ally to help me pull me out of my trigger. And we could talk about specifically what that looks like, because that happens often. And vice versa, versus when we're both really upset, you just spiral into this doom trigger thing that's just not very fun, but ultimately I think is a goldmine for the both of us because we learn so much from it.
We found the Enneagram particularly helpful personally and professionally in understanding it almost depersonalizes your core defense mechanisms because it shows you that they're a set of patterns that so many other people share. And so it's like, okay, this isn't me. This is a set of patterns. And like, I get to learn what those patterns feel like uniquely in my body when they come up. And as I start to learn what it feels like somatically, then I can start to be aware of when I'm getting triggered before I react to it, before I get like fully involved in, you know, being triggered and reacting. And when I can do that, then I actually have the chance to create some space between stimulus and response. And within that space, I can then breathe and I can make the choice that I want to make. And maybe the choice is to react in the way that I always would have. Maybe that's the appropriate response in that moment. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just having so much more range in how you respond. So, you know, an example, I think there are times where Aika has a pattern of a little one who is afraid that she's done something wrong, which, I mean, who doesn't have a little one who's afraid they've done something wrong? And you can all just kind of imagine that part of you who is like small, you know, maybe they're 3 or 4 or 5, maybe they're like hunched over and they're just like shivering and they're scared. And, you know, because of people's different defense mechanisms, they react in different ways to that. So for Aika as an Enneagram 8, she often reacts with anger. That's kind of like the first tool her defense mechanism reaches for. For me, it's like shutting down. So when I see this happening and I can like see it now, in her physicality, I can hear it in her voice. I can like see the sort of wave of this coming. I know that what she needs in that moment from me is just to become really soft and loving with her and speak directly to, see it happen right there. Speak directly to that part of her that's scared and just like come close and like touch her gently and say, oh yeah, I see your little one. I see that she's scared right now. It's okay. It's okay. Let's just take a minute. And what I think is so beautiful about this is that it is a way of reparenting yourself. And it's also great for parents of kids. It's like the same process being lived out with your past self and with your present self, with your kids.
Yeah. Turns out we're all just little kids with arrested development walking around in adult bodies. some are smaller adult bodies than other. I'm very small, but it really puts into perspective and again, relationship yoga, not necessarily just in romantic relationships. You see it in friendships, you see it in colleagues, but you know, like even at work, being able to see that when someone is acting disproportionate to what is happening, it's just a little one who's triggered. And for most of my life, I've buried that little one. And that little one doesn't have the opportunity to grow and mature and heal without attention and reparenting, whether that's reparenting myself or like us helping each other reparent our little ones. I mean, it's very like Dr. Becky. That's been a really big part of us, you know, maturing our relationship, becoming adults, stepping into the relationship that we want to have in the last decade that we've been together.
That's a really precious example. Is there any more examples? Do share them, maybe in sort of the reverse of when Camilla's triggered, but I'm also curious how you're able to do this when, as you said earlier, sometimes the triggers often are interlocking, right? And so how you're able to, you know, put so much attention on the other person's trigger when you yourself are going through a similar trigger.
One of the models I really like is internal family systems, IFS. And this just describes the idea that within our psyche, we have many different parts. And by sort of describing them as parts, it allows us to have a bit of distance from them and not say, oh, this is, you know, I'm angry. This is me. This is all of me. It's like, oh, there's a part that's angry. So when I feel my parts getting triggered, so I feel I have a one in me that's very stubborn, like immovably stubborn.
Oh, yeah.
That almost ended our marriage. So it is incredibly strong. If you know any Enneagram 8s, you know what it takes to stand up to them. I can feel somatically what it feels like when the stubborn one starts to get tight, when it starts to get reactive. And I can feel, this other one in me that is a little one that's afraid she's done something wrong. And because she's done something wrong, she's bad. She's like inherently bad and unlovable as a result. And so when I feel those parts start to react, and I know Ika's parts are also reacting, my favorite move right now comes from Hoffman. And it's so simple. It's called hands on heart. And it's literally, you just put both of your hands on your heart and you just breathe. And you feel your heartbeat and you just kind of go inside and talk to the parts and just be like, wow, I really see that you're here. Thank you for showing up for me. Because I'll tell you, the stubborn one always has my back, even if she can cause a lot of damage in the process. And the little one who thinks that I've done something wrong really just wants to stay in loving connection. And I so appreciate that about her. So I just like put my own oxygen mask on first and spend some time with those parts. And I tell Ika that that's what I'm doing. I'm like, hey, I need a minute to check in on myself. And often I think that gives you a chance to pause and kind of check in on your parts too.
Totally.
And then when I'm ready, when I'm like, okay, like my parts have calmed down. I'm ready to be in this interaction. Then I come back to it.
I think a critical skill we both have been honing in the last decade is the ability to put our awareness in our bodies, right? Like to be really somatically integrated, because I certainly started out like really just in my head. And so when the emotions happen, they kind of explode because I wasn't noticing the murmurs of them in the very beginning. So by the time they've registered in my conscious awareness, that's very mind-based, it's loud. And so, you know, we've been both meditating for a long time now. So much of that is cultivating, both on the mat and off the mat, this constant awareness of our system, whether it's our mind, our gut, our heart, our physical bodies. It's kind of like the thing that's running in the background of your computer, and you could see like which programs are running. You could X out the ones that are taking up too much RAM, et cetera. So it's this metacognition that's always running and understanding what is happening in the system. And that metacognition, I think, takes tons of practice. It's like a new, it's a new neural wiring to be constantly aware of. And then you, I think where it gets really fun is you can experience the start of emotions, thoughts, patterns, et cetera, at the very beginning. And to Camilla's point earlier, have a lot more choice in how I respond in a specific situation and have a lot more space between stimulus and response. I think this idea that we have free will is something I'm constantly interrogating on my own. And I don't think we have free will until you learn that kind of metacognition. Because for most people, they're just running patterns. I mean, for sure, like for most of my life and continue presently, we're mostly running patterns that have been set when we were kids. And behavior reward is behavior repeated. Some of those patterns have gotten us to where we are today. So it's very hard to change. So having that awareness has been really key for me in understanding the science and art of change. Like I think if there's the number one principle in our relationship and in our life is growth. And growth necessitates physical change in that your brain literally has to change. You need to cultivate neuroplasticity so you could create new neural wirings to be able to respond effectively into whatever new present situation is coming up versus just playing old tools and old patterns and, you know, trying to do the same thing over and over again. So I think growth requires a ton of metacognition, and growth requires a lot of ego death. It just to be able to let go of old patterns and old identities and old behaviors, you have to let go parts of yourself, surrender parts of yourself to be able to learn new ones and not be defined by all those things. So it's this interesting dynamic where this is something we talked about in our vows for our three weddings, where, you know, my commitment, my vow is not to just love the Camilla who was in front of me when we were doing the vows. It's to love all parts of her, the past, the present, and the future. And the reality is that I can't control the person Camilla is becoming or will become. We're all changing, right? And the vow is to actively be with whoever Camilla is in that moment. In that day, like every day is a new day. Every day, this is a new person. And I'm not just projecting my mental model, my old mental model of who Camilla is. And to embrace and accept and cherish the person she's becoming every new day. And that takes a lot of fucking work because it requires this level of interrogation in myself and not this projection of my mental models of this person, right? I think we do that all the time. We solidify who someone is in our minds. It's like, oh, I love this person because they're X, Y, and Z, and they do these X, Y, and Z things. Mm-hmm. There's going to come a time where that person is not going to be X, Y, and Z and not going to do those X, Y, and Z things. Then what? So it's very come what may. And it's a meta commitment versus a solid commitment of, you know, I'm going to love you as long as you stay X, Y, Z. It's really fucking boring.
Yeah, seeing with fresh eyes is always sort of a challenge and an opportunity.
Modern Relationships is sponsored by Relationship Hero, your personal relationship coach. It's an open secret in Silicon Valley that people are using these relationship coaches. Over 100,000 users are happy they tried Relationship Hero. You might be wondering, what is it like to talk to a relationship coach? Well, here's Jackie Pugh, a senior coach at Relationship Hero.
That's a really good question. Okay, I actually just got off a call with a client who was getting mixed signals from his ex. So she's the one that broke up with him, but then she kept sending him these really heartfelt, long, emotional messages at midnight, and then in the morning would act like nothing ever happened.
We've all been there. How do you recommend handling something like that?
So what we would do is we would want to hear exactly what's going on so we can help discern, is my client's ex, is she just trying to process her emotions and she's doing it via text message? Is she potentially trying to keep my client on the back burner? Or is she actually trying to reconnect? And if she is, then I help my client decide, you know, is this something that he actually wants to do, reconnect? And if so, why?
Thanks, Jackie. If you want to try your first one-on-one or couples coaching session, go to relationshiphero.com/modern. You'll get $50 off your first session if you use our link. Again, that's relationshiphero.com/modern.
One of my favorite books of all time, The Art of Loving by Eric Fromm. And it talks about how this book particularly is about romantic relationships, but I think this applies to every relationship. Dating has sort of become this weird capitalistic objectified thing where it's like, okay, I'm looking for, you know, the supply and demand match. And if I find the person who hits all of the check marks that I have, then we're going to be together and everything is going to be happily ever after.
And there's never going to be conflict.
And there's never going to be conflict. And you're right off in the sunset. And, you know, Disney princess movies, which I think have really fucked up our generation of humans in the 90s with crazy expectations. And again, applies beyond romantic relationships where, you know, if a person exhibits this kind of virtue or has this kind of trait, then that person is lovable. And because that person is lovable, then I can love that person. And that is definitionally not what love is. Love is accepting someone unconditionally. And also the premise that, you know, this person who I'm going to be together with is just going to remain that person forever without the temporal 4D of time is really silly. So the art of loving goes into the heart of, it's not that you can love someone if they're lovable because the object has satisfied these characteristics. So it's not that you fulfill these characteristics and then you love them, they become lovable, is that the love itself is an act of acceptance of whatever it is that's in front of you. And that's really hard. That's really hard because you have to shatter your own mental models of what is lovable. And I think that's what the work of being whole, coming back to what we're talking about in the very first moment of this conversation, the work of becoming whole yourself and the work of loving someone else are one and the same. It's this work of shattering all of the mental models that you have of what is lovable, including yourself, right? And I think this is, in some ways, this is why relationship yoga is so powerful, because whatever it is that is unloved in another person is the thing that is unloved in you, right? If I'm like, oh, that person is lazy, I don't like that. I don't like that person. It's because I don't allow laziness in myself. And I can have a preference to not be lazy and to work hard, but it becomes judgment when there's a sense of worth attached to it. And so when I see things in Camilla that pisses me off or bothers me, it's just things in myself that I haven't accepted in myself. So it's this beautiful dance of letting every single person you interact with, especially the primary person in your life, be a reflection of what is not yet whole in you. And then when you are whole, nothing really bothers you. Or just, you know, when we talk about Christianity, like kingdom of heaven on earth, or Tibetan Buddhism also has this idea of heaven on earth. I think that's what it is. It's that you are in the world and yet everything is perfect as it is.
That's what well articulated. You guys have been together for 10 years or 10 plus years. You know, it seems like a lot of your adulthood has been, you guys have grown up together in many ways. And for many couples, that's a model. For other people, they're sort of, you know, have been in relationships, but they find themselves in their sort of mid to late 30s or beyond, haven't yet found their person. And maybe they've done a lot of their work. I'm curious if you could imagine if you were both single now, like what that would be like. You know, it's almost like pre-formed versus formed in some sense. And I think one challenge the latter has is maybe the checklist gets more narrow, or because when you're, you know, willing to grow up with somebody or you're pre-formed, you're sort of more flexible perhaps. But I'm just curious if you can reflect on that, because, you know, it's a bit of a thing.
Yeah, this is something that we've talked about. And, you know, we've had the experience that we've had. And so it's hard to imagine what life would have been like without that. I think I can kind of chart my life path very concretely from when, like, pre-ICA and post-ICA. And So I don't know what it would be like to be single now, because I don't know, and kind of looking for a partner, because I don't know if like my growth would have looked at all like what it's looked like. I think so much of my growth has been catalyzed from our partnership, even though it was something that I was deeply interested in before getting together with Aika. One of the things that I have learned a lot about over the past year and a half or so is this idea of basic trust. So basic trust is a fundamental sense of peace and well-being, with the notion that the universe is inherently kind and has your back. Like, it is working on your behalf at all times. I have a good friend who once said, you know, I'm always waiting for the universe to disappoint me, and it never does. And that's just stuck with me. So from a place of basic trust, I am in real surrender to what is presently, and also what is sort of coming into my life. And I would imagine that if I were, you know, someone who had done a lot of personal work and was looking to find a partner who maybe was similarly oriented, then I would just put myself in places where those people tend to hang out. And I would trust the universe that the right person who was meant to show up at the right time would, because how could it be otherwise? Which I know is easier said than done, having talked to a lot of our single friends.
Yeah, I think I have a much more simple take on it.
Okay.
I think my hypothesis is that it is harder to find, or maybe it is harder to find and be in partnership as you get older. Precisely because the checklist gets longer and the mental models get stronger.
Reified.
It is much more reified versus, I think when we're young, we didn't really have a checklist. It's like, oh, Camilla's smart and hot and kind and, you know, like pretty fundamentally like basic shortlist versus.
Yeah, because the goal is not, I'm going to spend the rest of my life with you. The goal is like, we're going to, you know, hang out together for.
Yeah, we're going to hook up. Right? It's not like, oh my God, this is going to be the mother of my child and someone I spend the rest of my life with. Like, I was 23 when we got together. Camilla was 24. Like, our prefrontal cortex weren't totally developed yet. So the mental models are what get you, I think, in the dating. And we've seen it a lot with friends who are dating, trying to find their person. It's like, oh my God, this person did this small innocuous thing during the date, like game over, deal breaker. It's like, is that really the deal breaker? You know, it doesn't have to be. And I think the advantage of getting together young, we didn't have those strong mental models. And we just learned that really early on, the things that we thought mattered didn't really matter. And also, just by virtue of being together for so long, it's like we've gotten into huge fights. We have almost broken up before, you know, like we're on our second marriage, as we like to call it. And every fight, every friction, every end is an opportunity to shatter whatever mental model I had before and maybe create a new mental model. But it's just this constant process of just letting go and dying and rebirth. And so when I see my friends now who are in their 30s and they're dating, they're trying to find their person, they're trying too hard to hold on to the mental models and use that as the filter versus learning and practicing this core skill of dying and reinventing your mental models, whether it's with yourself or with someone else. And like, that's the thing to look for. It's not that, you know, this person has an income of this, or this person dresses this certain way, or this person picks the right restaurant, or this person, you know, knows what to do for aftercare. All of those things are fungible and teachable. The key thing is this someone who you could go through the process of constantly updating and re-updating each other's mental models? Like, that is the meta thing to look for. It's like, do they have the capacity and the character to be able to do that over and over again? Because life is long. Life is short, but life is also long. If you're going to spend it with someone, that is prerequisite.
At least for us.
No, I love that move, framing it of sort of, you know, re-updating mental models together. I'm curious, you alluded to the challenges a couple times, or sort of this idea that every, you know, there's a new marriage every 7 years. What can other couples learn from challenges you guys have faced, and how you've been able to bounce back from it? Because a lot don't, and maybe they shouldn't, but often maybe they could. Maybe they could make it work, or could have made it work. So.
I forget if it's Esther Perel or Diana Chapman who said every marriage ends every 7 years, but something that Diana's talked about with her husband Matt is that she's been married 3 times, just the same person. So we have this framework. It's like, okay, we're on our second marriage. Going back to what we were saying before, it's like, okay, each person changes over time, right? And two people alongside each other who are constantly changing in parallel, whatever our relationship was 10 years ago is certainly not the relationship we have today, because we each have changed tremendously. And so the patterns that were interlocking 10 years ago, or the triggers that we had for each other 10 years ago, are very different than the patterns and triggers that we have today. And the way I think about each chapter of a marriage is the patterns are there to create this pressure for each of us to really see our dance, our part of the dance. And we can heal ourselves out of patterns the easy way or the hard way. For most of us, including Camilla and I, we've done it mostly the hard way. Right? It's like you really trigger and you bother the shit out of each other until finally it explodes and there's a lot of hurt, et cetera. So for us, like, we went through this in 2023, and Camille can talk a little bit about it, but it was like freaking purgatory, man. Like, it was the hardest time of my adult life. And we really hurt each other. Like, we were so stuck in our patterns, we really hurt each other. And after all of that came to a point where it's like, okay, we're going to go heal ourselves from the hurt we caused to each other and learn how to take some of the spice out of the trigger and then come back together and build new patterns together. So this is, you know, I did Hoffman in November of 2023, Camilla did it in April 2024. And that was really helpful because so much of our patterns are just shit from childhood that we've picked up that are rearing its head, right? So like for me, a big one was abandonment. In small ways and big ways, both of my parents, I experienced that they abandoned me. And so this is like a core childhood fear. And that was what was really triggered for me in that 2023, like, combustible phase that we had. And what was wild was I went to Hoffman, worked on a bunch of things, you know, through childhood, particularly all this hurt around abandonment. And coming out of it, I felt the highest level of neuroplasticity I've ever experienced in life. And I've done a fair amount of psychedelics and was able to really let go of that. So it's like, it is rare now that I get triggered around the abandonment stuff. It's like, sometimes it still happens, but like 2% of what it was before. And because of that, that creates room for us to show up in the relationship where we're not playing out the same fights as we did in the first chapter. You know, like, we're in the process of trying to have kids. Like, as we have kids, as we go into the second chapter of our marriage, I'm sure other patterns will crop up. But the stuff that used to be the bulk of, like, the drama of being together are no longer the things that we have fights about. And that required not just both of us doing our work, but like each of us doing our internal individual work, because whenever we have a fight, what we realize is we're not just two people having a fight about that thing. It's like two people with baggage from both of our lives that some we know of, some we don't.
Yeah. What's coming up for me is that patterns interlock because they want to liberate. And if I can remember that, then every time I get triggered or our patterns interlock, instead of being like, ah, oh, like, fuck this person, I'm like, yes, like, here it is. Here's the gold. Because sometimes it's hard to access it. And like, part of the gift of a trigger is it's right there. And so for us, as Aika was describing, we both obviously had these like very deeply rooted patterns that we picked up in early childhood. And they really wanted to be liberated.
Can you flesh that out a little bit?
Yeah, I guess I have an underlying belief that all humans want to not suffer. And the way that we create suffering for ourselves is by believing our thoughts instead of being willing to just be with exactly what is in the moment. And our patterns are just these like constant projectors that are running at the screen of what is, telling us what we should think is happening instead of allowing us to just be with the screen blank as it is or whatever's on it. And so the way that our patterns come together, we talked about this a little bit earlier, that, you know, a lot of times you feel drawn to someone who you like have these interlocks with. I think the reason that that happens is because our patterns want to become self-aware of themselves. Our patterns want to be able to see themselves in the light of day so that they can be liberated, which doesn't mean they go away. It just means that they're no longer playing a very specific role in your life. It means that they can be of service with all of the gifts that they have instead of running you unconsciously. And what that looked like for us, because these were such deep patterns, as Aika said, there's a hard way to do it and there's an easy way to do it. The easy way is that you are already aware of all of these things happening. And so you can hear the like gentle nudges from the universe being like, hey, you know, here's a blind spot. Here's something you're not paying attention to. But when your nervous system is perpetually in a state of fight or flight, which for most of us is the case, you are not able to listen to those cues. And so the universe just keeps putting more and more pressure on until you are in a place where your entire marriage is, you know, burned to the ground, as was the case for us. And I think it was for both of us this deep sense of like trusting the liberation of these patterns, trusting that that was what was on the other side of this, regardless of whether or not we stayed together, that it was worth going through that discomfort. It was worth sitting in that pain and that suffering because we knew what was on the other side. And that liberation is so, it's literally a different reality. It is living in a completely different reality. And that, I think, these sort of moments of really intense hardship in relationships can be portals to something that is vastly better that, you know, no one can even conceive of in the moment.
Well said.
Thanks, my love.
When couples are getting to that 7-year mark or when people are having, when couples are just having trouble in their marriage more broadly after a long time together, is it, or common patterns that you identify or see sort of because a lack of connection? Is it because of sort of a lack of stability? Is it because of sort of like growing apart? Are these all sort of, you know, symptoms of something similar or overlapping? Is this the wrong way to think about it?
I would imagine that pretty reliably it would be the core defense mechanisms of each person's Enneagram type interlocking with each other, like these sort of deepest things in us that want to be seen and recognized. I would have a feeling that it's those at the root.
Yeah.
And so reading it, certainly, you know, we use Enneagram all the time, but reading about your Enneagram type and really kind of developing an understanding of what those patterns look like and what they look like when they lock in with each other, I think that's wildly useful.
The other person, I mean, this is a huge exaggeration, but the other person almost doesn't matter. Whatever your patterning is, it's going to show up in any relationship unless you heal it, right? So for me as an Enneagram 8, Camille's an Enneagram 9. As an Enneagram 8, my core defense mechanism is to survive. I must be independent and not rely on others. In other words, I can't trust other people or rely on other people. And regardless of Camilla or if it's someone else, that's just going to show up until I deal with it. Like my mind is looking for data points to support that defense mechanism, regardless of who the person is in front of me. And again, that goes with romantic relationships, friendships, work relationships, et cetera. So yes, I think there are particulars when it comes to two people in a relationship going through long periods of time, but the time is just like a pressure cooker for each of those people's defense mechanisms. And you could choose to address them or not. They're just, if you don't address them, they will show up in your next relationship. If you do choose to address them, then there's an opportunity to see, once you heal those parts, if this is the person that you want to continue in a relationship with, right? But what I see all the time is this knee-jerk instinct of, this is not the right person. I'm just going to go find another person who better fulfills my mental models. It's like, bro, it's going to show up again. Like, it's not them, it's you. And that's, I think, a key part and a huge part of why I think we made it through the transom to through like the dark night of the soul of our relationship and the first part of our relationship, where I think we both fundamentally believe that there's no running away from the work. Like, the work is just going to continue to show up over and over and over again. You could address it now. You could address it 5 years from now. You could address it 50 years from now. You got to address it.
I think the other piece that was so important for us was that we had really wonderful friends who loved and saw both of us equally.
Shout out Jessica Cole.
Yes. And so they could kind of hold this container where we could be fully honest with them and trust that they wouldn't make it mean anything about the other person. And one of the things that Jessica Cole in particular talked about was this idea of concentric circles of support. So often when we're in distress or having a hard time, we go in towards the sort of closer circles. And that's actually quite challenging, because if what you're having trouble with is someone in that circle, then it just like creates more friction. But if you can step out into the larger circles and get your support there, then it means that you've got people who really have the kind of bandwidth and distance and clarity to be able to fully support you as I went through my roller coasters of, you know, lots of emotion and heartache and anger and everything else.
Yeah. I think practically, you know, you go to a friend and you're upset with your spouse about something. I think what most people do is the friend then validates your stories, mm-hmm. right? It's like, yeah, she is being blah, blah, blah. And, you know, no, like you should say no to that.
What an asshole.
Yeah. And there's time and place for that. Like, I think venting is healthy and some people need that. But I think to do this kind of work of, again, updating mental models and repairing and growing, there are these sacred containers that are needed where you have friends who are able to support both of you without losing respect and love for the other person, right? So in the case of Jess, like, we both could go to her and trust that we can be as upset as we are in the moment, and she's not going to make it mean anything about the other person or like invalidate that other person. So like, when Camilla's going to Jess, I trust that Jess is not like, yeah, wow, you should just leave Ica. Like, you know,
can confirm she did not say that.
Like, Jess can validate how Camilla's feeling, but not participate in the stories. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, challenge the stories. And she did that for both of us. And Diana Chapman is another friend. And our best friends, Diana and Riwan, also did this, where really holding the commitment to support both parties within the relationship, where their job is not to, like, again, if the stories of the mental models are the thing that are mutable and the thing that often creates suffering, we've been very, very lucky to have friends who are here to help us question our stories and ultimately evolve out of them. I feel so wealthy thinking about that, that we have friends who can do that for us. So grateful.
I do just want to note that obviously there are relationships in which abuse occurs.
Yep.
And this is not the right set of tools for those relationships. Those require a whole other set of tools. As someone who has like been in abusive relationships in the past, that is something that like a trained professional should really be supporting around. So don't try and like soldier through the hardship in that situation. Yeah, please.
You said that you almost broke up, which maybe implies, or just for this hypothetical, that if there were 1,000 universes, you could roll the die thousands of times. Maybe in one of those universes, it didn't work out. I say that to ask, when you are advising friends, or if you were to give advice to people who are sort of unsure, uncertain, hey, you know, we've been doing this, we've been in a relationship, there's some things that are great about it, there's some real challenges, we're really struggling, genuinely don't know if we should continue trying or not. But what kind of advice do you give them, or what kind of questions do you ask to help them come to the conclusion of answering that question?
I think having a little space is really, really helpful during those times. One of the things that Diana walked us through, which for various reasons we didn't end up implementing, but we kind of did a version of it, is I forget what she calls it, but it's basically a structured separation where you take, it's a 3-month process in total. The first month, you just both take space. You're like not living in the same place together. You're both just existing on your own and remembering what it feels like to be at home in yourself, to kind of live your life. And then in month 2, you start by having a coffee date that like doesn't last more than an hour. And you just like notice. You notice what comes up for you. You notice how it feels to be with the person. Ideally, you're doing this with the support of a coach or a therapist. And then after that, you both meet with that person who's supporting you, and you individually decide if you want to go on another date. And as you continue to decide to go on dates, they get longer and longer. Eventually, they involve physical intimacy. But it's this real slow reintroduction of being together and kind of what that really means to you. I would say, just watching our good friends who have gone through divorce, the thing that always seems to be true is that people feel more themselves and they feel happier when they're alone than when they're with that other person. And so that, you know, those can be things to listen to if that's your experience. And then to get support around. And, you know, I love how Esther Perel talks about this. She's talking about marriage specifically, but she's like, there's no such thing as a failed marriage. Even a marriage that ends was, you know, this incredibly important way of two people learning about themselves and about each other. And there is so much good that comes from that. So I think this idea that like relationships are only successful if they last forever is very silly and also just not based in reality. And there can be something really beautiful and powerful that ends.
I feel like a useful term for me, useful framework, is this idea that we're co-founders for life. And if you, not that startup framework solves everything, but it helps a lot for me. And looking at it as if you're two co-founders and you have this startup, this project that's life, right? Is it a functional co-foundership? Do you have the same values? Do you share the same values, vision, direction? Do you help each other become better at what you do and in your core being? And even in the darkest parts of our relationship, it's like, yes, like this is my co-founder for life. This is who I want to build a life with. The friction are evolutionary process for us to become more of who we are. And that's been really helpful. It's just, it keeps things in perspective for me. And I've seen some friends where, you know, they have great chemistry. They may have a lot of uncommon, but would you say if hypothetically they were to start a company, these are the two people who should be together to start that company, whatever that means, right? Whether it's a family or a life that you want. If the answer is no, you shouldn't be together. So it's, we have all these frameworks to talk about what, like who you should be co-founders with. And I think in many ways, they're parallel and apply to romantic relationships as well. And there is something inherently different in romantic relationships than platonic relationships, and that there is this building that happens, right? You're like, you're building a life together. You're probably cohabitating. Maybe you're starting a family, but there is a shared vision of what you want to create. It is inherently a creative union in a way that I think friendships are a lot more elastic. Like, I may have projects with friends, but with friends, there isn't this commitment of, hey, there's a goal that we're trying to achieve together. So tech startups, romantic relationships have a lot of parallels in that regard. So in that way, you know, is this someone, and in the same way that in co-founderships, you think about how do you manage conflict? Do you have this shared values and milestones that you want to hit together? What do you do when there are many other people dependent on you? How do you run the startup? How do you run the household? So I think we both benefit a lot in the language that we use just from our professional lives and bringing that into our personal lives, and really seeing our partnership as a co-foundership. You know, like, this is my co-founder for life. And that is a really different role than a friend.
The other piece of this that I've reflected to a number of our friends is that when you find the person you're supposed to be with, the way you know is that you are an even brighter, more glittering, more alive version of yourself with that person.
I love that. I think one thing that's interesting is sort of, or there's this tension around, like, you know, someone could listen to this conversation and say, oh, you know, if someone triggers me, that's, you know, it's a good sign. There's sign for growth there. Although sometimes, you know, we both, you know, I'm sure have friends who've been in relationships where they, you know, they're fighting all the time, right? And then it doesn't seem the kind that is leading them to growth. And so, you know, except that maybe it's hard to, or people just constantly pick people that are bad for them, right? And then there's also the opposite side where the people that are, they work well with together, maybe there's no chemistry, there's no attraction, or there's not enough tension or edge, or, you know, whatever is kind of the spark that's needed to get them together. And so there's always just this sort of delicate balance or this tension there.
The thing that comes to mind as you talk about that, Eric, is the role of boundaries. We're pretty poorly taught in general, I think, as a society, as a generation, around boundaries. And boundaries are a critical tool for love, whether it's self-love or love for others. I really like how Dr. Becky puts it in terms of parenting. You have a kid who's having a tantrum. They're hitting other people or they're hitting themselves. You can love that kid and you can still assert boundaries and stop them from hurting themselves or from hurting other people, right? And that's going to differ person to person. And so this aspect of, like, when we trigger each other, we learn, using that as a learning opportunity, as long as they stay within, like, the boundaries of what is healthy for us. And this is where we've seen friends go through emotional, physically abusive relationships. Like, boundaries is a form of self-love, right? So it's like, if you're seeing triggers as a form of learning, but you're not honoring your own boundaries and you're putting yourself in danger, I would say danger is probably the critical measurement here. Like, are you in danger? Then it doesn't matter what you learn. You're in danger. Like, Maslow's hierarchy, right? Gotta take care of the base needs first. And so I feel really lucky and privileged that we have fulfilled so many of the bottom rungs of Maslow's hierarchies that we can engage in this type of relationship, in the relationship yoga. But that's not true for everyone. So it's like, you gotta take care of yourself first. And if you're putting yourself in danger, you're putting other people in danger, gotta address that first before you do any of this shit of learning.
I think the other thing is that it is almost impossible to be open and curious enough to learn when your nervous system is in a state of fight or flight. And so if you were in a situation where you two are just constantly going at it, no one's going to be able to learn actively in the moment that you're, like, just going from one fight to another. And so being able to take that space from each other to calm down and then to do the work, to feel it. And, you know, there's so many different modalities for doing that, but really being willing to take an honest look at yourself and see where you are not yet loving different parts that's, you know, creating this reactivity. That's where the gold is. And you don't need to be in relationship with a person to do that, right? you can do this with past relationships where you two are no longer together. You can still sit down and be like, all right, I can vividly call to mind this fight we had that I'm still fucking pissed off about. And just like call that up for yourself and then go through the process of listening to the parts and doing the work and get the gold from that, because there is real gold there. And that will benefit every future relationship you have, including the one with yourself.
Yep.
Is there anything else that you guys have learned as a couple that you want to make sure to leave our audience with, or that something that you observe as it relates to anything we've been discussing about whether it's finding your person, or once you're with your person, making it fantastic or recovering when it isn't?
The thing that comes up for me is to really take care of each other's little ones. Like, can you be right there with the little one and see them as this little kid who's just sad or scared? And I think that becomes such an unlock for open-heartedness and compassion in those moments. And it helps to build that bridge from, you know, that other person's trigger interlocking with your trigger to that other person's trigger just opening your heart and allowing you to really be there and see them.
I think for me, it's don't overthink. I think we're really intentional in how we approach our relationship. But at the very core of it, it's like, I see Camilla and my entire body wells up. And there's no amount of thinking and mental modeling yourself into that. And that initial spark that brought us together is still here and is even more alive 10 years into the relationship, right? So it's just like, you can't catch that in a bottle. So when you do feel that way, that spark with someone, don't self-sabotage yourself. I see this all the time. People are like, oh, well, you know, this checklist, that checklist, et cetera. It's just like, it's so rare. Like, that connection is winning the lottery. And I hope people don't squander that, because that is, it really over here feels like winning the lottery every day.
Wow. Well, yeah, it seems like as you guys, you know, it doesn't feel like this every day maybe, but it feels like overall you guys have grown closer together. Where I feel, and couples who have that, seem, you know, that's the dream, right? Whereas it feels like for some others, sometimes it feels they've grown apart, that there was a, you know, initial spark around attraction or something, but there just wasn't enough to grow in directions that were compatible.
I think that connection, this is a pretty shitty formula that's very half-baked right now, but I think that connection is some combination of spark, attraction, and intimacy,
which is
Diana always says
so
Micah hates it.
Try
it's in to me see.
Oh my god, it's so like dad joke.
I love dad jokes.
Into me see.
Mm-hmm. And the attraction is out of my control, but the intimacy is absolutely in my control. And that intimacy is very hard to practice. It seems so simple, but hard to practice. It is seeing the person fresh every day, every moment, and not letting my mental models get in the way of that. So it is this seeing the other person requires that you die all the time. I die all the time to be able to see, to be able to make room for what is, for who that person is in that moment. I can't have my agenda, my projection of what that person is. And that's why intimacy is so hard when you're fighting, right? When you're fighting, it's because you're triggered. You have your defense mechanisms. You have your mental models of the world and the person in front of you. And you can't see. You can't see the other person by definition. You can't see yourself. So that, and I think so much of the art of repair after you fight, inevitably you're going to fight with the other person. If there's no friction in your relationship, that's weird. That probably means both of you are just suppressing shit. But so much of the repair, I think, is like coming back to that intimacy and allowing space for you to be triggered, but then also to come back and surrender your mental models to be able to see the other person. And that, I think, that's critical in continuing the spark.
Also appreciations.
Yeah, those are great.
I think one of the things we've gotten really good at is when you're able to be present and see the person you love, then just vocalizing to them as it's happening, the things that you see them doing or the way you see them being that is just like so gorgeous to you, so incredible, so inspiring. Whether it's, you know, being grateful that they unloaded and reloaded the dishwasher or being amazed at how incredible their Claude prompts are. Just like really having that reverence and kind of joyful appreciation goes a long way.
Yeah. There's this one quote, conflict is the test by which people learn how much they matter to each other, or conflict is how you care. And it could be an opportunity to get closer, an opportunity to get further.
Yeah, definitely agree with that. Beautiful quote.
On that note, Camilla, Aika, thank you so much for coming to the podcast and sharing your story and your lessons learned with us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Thank you, Eric.
Thanks for listening to Modern Relationships. Please make sure you're following on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. If you have a chance, leave us a review or comment on this episode to let me know who else you'd like to hear from on this show. Modern Relationships is a podcast from Turpentine, the network behind Econ 102, Upstream, and Turpentine VC.